Random House Audible presents The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, a Leadership Fable by Patrick Lencioni, read for you by Charles Stransky, with an introduction read by the author.
Not finance, not strategy, not technology. It is teamwork that remains the ultimate competitive advantage, both because it is so powerful and so rare. A friend of mine, the founder of a company that grew to $1 billion in annual revenue, best expressed the power of teamwork when he once told me, if you could get all of the people in an organization rowing in the same direction, you could dominate any industry, in any market, against any competition, at any time. Whenever I repeat that adage to a group of leaders, they immediately nod their heads, but in a desperate sort of way. They seem to grasp the truth of it while simultaneously surrendering to the impossibility of actually making it happen. And that is where the rarity of teamwork comes into play. For all the attention that it has received over the years from scholars, coaches, teachers, and the media, teamwork is as elusive as it has ever been within most organizations. The fact remains that teams, because they are made up of imperfect human beings, are inherently dysfunctional. But that is not to say that teamwork is doomed. Far from it. In fact, building a strong team is both possible and remarkably simple. But it is painfully difficult. That's right, like so many other aspects of life, teamwork comes down to mastering a set of behaviors that are at once theoretically uncomplicated, but extremely difficult to put into practice day after day. Success comes only for those groups that overcome the all-too-human behavioral tendencies that corrupt teams and breed dysfunctional politics within them. As it turns out, these principles apply to more than just teamwork. In fact, I stumbled upon them somewhat by accident in my pursuit of a theory about leadership. A few years ago, I wrote my first book, The Five Temptations of a CEO, about the behavioral pitfalls that plague leaders. In the course of working with my clients, I began to notice that some of them were misusing my theories in an effort to assess and improve the performance of their leadership teams, and with success. And so it became apparent to me that the five temptations applied not only to individual leaders, but with a few modifications to groups as well. And not just within corporations, either. Clergy, coaches, teachers, and others found that these principles applied in their worlds as much as they did in the executive suite of a multinational company. And that is how this book came to be. Like my other books, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team begins with a story written in the context of a realistic but fictional organization. I have found that this allows readers to learn more effectively by losing themselves in a story and by being able to relate to the characters. It also helps them understand how these principles can be applied in a non-theoretical, real-world environment, where the pace of work and the volume of daily distractions make even the simplest of tasks seem arduous. In order to help you apply the material in your own organization, a brief section following the story outlines the five dysfunctions in detail. That section also includes a team assessment and suggested tools for overcoming the issues that might be plaguing your team. Finally, although this book is based on my work with CEOs and their executive teams, its theories are applicable for anyone interested in teamwork, whether you lead a small department within a company or are simply a member of a team that could use some improvement. Whatever the case may be, I sincerely hope it helps your team overcome its particular dysfunctions so that it can achieve more than individuals could ever imagine doing alone. That, after all, is the real power of teamwork.
The Fable. Luck. Only one person thought Catherine was the right choice to become CEO of Decision Tech, Inc. Luckily for her, that person was the chairman of the board. And so, less than a month after the previous chief executive had been removed, Catherine Peterson took the reins of a company that just 2 years earlier had been one of the most talked-about, well-funded, and promising startup companies in the recent history of the Silicon Valley. She could not have known just how far from grace the company had fallen in such a short period of time, and what the next few months had in store for her. Part 1. Underachievement. Backstory. Decision Tech was located in Half Moon Bay, a foggy coastal farming town just over the hills from the San Francisco Bay. It was not technically part of the Silicon Valley, but the valley is not so much a geographical entity as a cultural one, and Decision Tech certainly fit within that world. It had the most experienced and expensive executive team imaginable, a seemingly indestructible business plan, and more top-tier investors than any young company could hope for. Even the most cautious venture firms were lining up to invest, and talented engineers were submitting their resumes before the company had leased an office. But that was almost 2 years earlier, which is a lifetime for a technology startup. After its first few euphoric months of existence, the company began experiencing a series of ongoing disappointments. Critical deadlines started to slip. A few key employees below the executive level unexpectedly left the company. Morale deteriorated gradually. All of this in spite of the considerable advantages that Decision Tech had amassed for itself. On the 2-year anniversary of the firm's founding, the board unanimously agreed to ask Jeff Shanley, the company's 37-year-old CEO and co-founder, to step down. He was offered the job of heading business development, and, to the surprise of his colleagues, he accepted the demotion, not wanting to walk away from a potentially huge payout should the company eventually go public. And even in the difficult economic climate of the Valley, the company had every reason to go public. None of Decision Tech's 150 employees were shocked by Jeff's removal. While most of them seemed to like him well enough personally, they couldn't deny that under his leadership, the atmosphere within the company had become increasingly troubling. Backstabbing among the executives had become an art. There was no sense of unity or camaraderie on the team, which translated into a muted level of commitment. Everything seemed to take too long to get done, and even then, it never felt right. Some boards might have been more patient with a stumbling executive team. Decision Tech's was not. There was just too much at stake and too high a profile to watch the company waste away because of politics. Decision Tech had already developed a reputation within the Valley for being one of the most political and unpleasant places to work, and the board couldn't tolerate that kind of press, especially when the future had looked so promising just a couple of years earlier. Someone had to be accountable for the mess, and Jeff was the man at the top. Everyone seemed relieved when the board announced the decision to remove him, until 3 weeks later, when Catherine was hired. Catherine. The executives couldn't agree on which of Catherine's features presented the biggest problem. There were so many. First, she was old, ancient, at least by Silicon Valley standards. Catherine was 57. More important, she had no real high-tech experience other than serving as a board member of Trinity Systems, a large technology company in San Francisco. Most of her career had been spent in operational roles with decidedly low-tech companies, the most notable of which was an automobile manufacturer. But more than her age or experience, Catherine just didn't seem to fit the Decision Tech culture. She had started her career in the military, then married a teacher and basketball coach at a local high school. After raising 3 boys, she taught 7th grade for a few years until she discovered her affinity for business. At the age of 37, Catherine enrolled in a 3-year business school night program, which she completed a semester early at Cal State Hayward, which was not exactly Harvard or Stanford. She then spent the next 15 years in and around manufacturing until her retirement at the age of 54. The fact that Catherine was a woman was never an issue for the executive team. 2 of them were women themselves. With much of their collective experience coming from the somewhat progressive world of high tech, most had worked for women at some time during their careers. But even if her gender had been a problem for anyone on the team, it would have been dwarfed by her glaring cultural mismatch. There was just no mistaking the fact that, on paper, Catherine was an old-school, blue-collarish executive. That presented a stark contrast to the Decision Tech executives and middle managers, most of whom had little experience working outside of the Valley. Some of them even liked to brag that they hadn't worn a suit outside of a wedding since graduating from college. It was no surprise that, after first reading her resume, board members questioned the chairman's sanity when he suggested they hire Catherine, but he eventually wore them down. For one, the board believed their chairman when he flat out assured them that Catherine would succeed. Second, he had been known to have extremely good instincts about people, notwithstanding the problem with Jeff. He certainly wouldn't make 2 mistakes in a row, they reasoned. But perhaps, most important of all, though no one would admit it, Decision Tech was in a desperate situation. The chairman insisted that there weren't too many capable executives willing to take on such a messy job, given the current state of affairs at the scarred company. We should consider ourselves lucky to have such a capable leader as Catherine available, he successfully argued. Whether or not that was true, the chairman was determined to hire someone he knew and could trust. When he called Catherine to tell her about the job, he certainly could not have known that he would be regretting the decision just a few weeks later. Rationale. No one was more surprised about the offer than Catherine. Although she had known the chairman for many years on a personal level, Catherine had actually first met him when her husband coached his oldest son in high school, she could not have imagined that he thought so highly of her as an executive. Most of the relationship had been social, centering around family, school, and local athletics. Catherine assumed that the chairman had little idea about her life outside her role as a mother and coach's wife. In fact, the chairman had followed Catherine's career with interest over the years, amazed at how successful she had become with such relatively modest training. In less than 5 years, she had become chief operating officer of the Bay Area's only automobile manufacturing plant, a U.S.-Japanese joint venture. She held that job for the better part of a decade and made the plant one of the most successful cooperative enterprises in the country. And while the chairman knew little about the car industry, he knew one thing about Catherine that convinced him she was perfect to fix the problems at Decision Tech. She had an amazing gift for building teams. Grumblings. If the executives at Decision Tech had any doubts about Catherine when her hiring was first announced, and they did, they were even more concerned after their new leader's first 2 weeks on the job. It wasn't that Catherine did anything controversial or misplaced. It was that she did almost nothing at all. Aside from a brief reception on her first day and subsequent interviews with each of her direct reports, Catherine spent almost all of her time walking the halls, chatting with staff members, and silently observing as many meetings as she could find time to attend. And perhaps most controversial of all, she actually asked Jeff Shanley to continue leading the weekly executive staff meetings, where she just listened and took notes. The only real action that Catherine took during those first weeks was to announce a series of 2-day executive retreats in the Napa Valley to be held over the course of the next few months. As though she needed to give them any more ammunition, none of her reports could believe she had the gall to take them out of the office for so many days when there was so much real work to be done. And, to make matters worse, when someone suggested a specific topic for discussion during the first retreat, Catherine refused. She had her own agenda already set. Even the chairman was surprised and a bit unnerved about the reports of Catherine's early performance. He came to the conclusion that if she didn't work out, he should probably leave along with her. That was beginning to feel like the most probable outcome. Observations. After her first 2 weeks observing the problems at Decision Tech, Catherine had more than a few moments when she wondered if she should have taken the job. But she knew that there was little chance that she would have turned it down. Retirement had made her antsy, and nothing excited her more than a challenge. While there was no doubt that Decision Tech would be a challenge, something seemed different about this one. Though she had never really feared failure, Catherine could not deny that the prospect of letting the chairman down spooked her a little. To tarnish a reputation so late in her career and among friends and family was enough to worry even the most secure of people. And Catherine was certainly secure with herself. After surviving a stint in the military, raising her boys, watching countless buzzer-beating basketball games, and standing up to union bosses, Catherine decided she was not about to be intimidated by a bunch of harmless yuppies, whose greatest hardships in life so far had been fighting off the first signs of a receding hairline or an expanding waistline. She believed that as long as the board would give her enough time and leeway, she would be able to turn Decision Tech around. And Catherine's lack of in-depth software experience did not concern her. In fact, she felt certain that it provided her with an advantage. Most of her staff seemed almost paralyzed by their own knowledge of technology, as though they themselves would have to do the programming and product design to make the company fly. Catherine knew that Jack Welch didn't have to be an expert on toaster manufacturing to make General Electric a success, that Herb Kelleher didn't have to spend a lifetime flying airplanes to build Southwest Airlines. Despite what her limited technical background might have indicated, Catherine felt that her understanding of enterprise software and technology was more than sufficient for her to lead Decision Tech out of the mess it was in. What she could not have known when she accepted the job, however, was just how dysfunctional her executive team was and how they would challenge her in ways that no one before had ever done. The staff. Employees referred to the decision tech executives as the staff. No one referred to them as a team, which Catherine decided was no accident. In spite of their undeniable intelligence and impressive educational backgrounds, the staff's behavior during meetings was worse than anything she had seen in the automotive world. Though open hostility was never really apparent and no one ever seemed to argue, an underlying tension was undeniable. As a result, decisions never seemed to get made, discussions were slow and uninteresting with few real exchanges, and everyone seemed to be desperately waiting for each meeting to end. And yet, as bad as the team was, they all seemed like well-intentioned and reasonable people when considered individually, with just a few exceptions. Jeff, former CEO, Business Development. Essentially a generalist who loved networking within the Valley, Jeff Shanley had raised a considerable amount of the company's initial money and attracted many of the current executives. No one could deny his prowess when it came to venture capital recruiting, but management was another story. Jeff ran staff meetings as though he were a student body president, reading from a textbook on protocol. He always published an agenda before each meeting and then distributed detailed minutes afterward. And, unlike most other high-tech companies, his meetings usually began on time and always concluded exactly when they were scheduled to end. The fact that nothing ever seemed to get done during those meetings didn't appear to bother him. In spite of his demotion, Jeff maintained his seat on the board of directors. Catherine initially suspected that he might resent her for taking his job, but she soon came to the conclusion that Jeff was relieved to be, well, relieved of his management responsibilities. Catherine had little concern about his presence on the board or on her management team. She suspected that his heart was in the right place. Mikey, marketing. Marketing would be a critical function at Decision Tech, and the board had been ecstatic to get someone as sought after as Michelle Beebe. Mikey, as she liked to be called, was well known throughout the Valley as a brand-building genius, which made it all the more astonishing that she lacked a few key social graces. During meetings, she talked more than the others, occasionally coming up with a brilliant idea, but more often complaining about how the other companies she had worked for did everything better than Decision Tech. It was almost as though she were a spectator, or better yet, a victim of circumstance at her new company. Though she never argued outright with any of her peers, she was known to roll her eyes in apparent disgust when one of them disagreed with anything she had to say about marketing. Catherine decided that Mikey was unaware of how she came across to others. No one would purposefully act that way, she reasoned. So, in spite of her talent and accomplishments, it was no surprise to Catherine that Mikey was the least popular among the rest of the staff, with the possible exception of Martin. Martin, chief technologist. A founder of the company, Martin Gilmore was the closest thing that Decision Tech had to an inventor. He had designed the original specs for the company's flagship product, and although others had done much of the actual product development, the executives often said that Martin was the keeper of the crown jewels. That analogy was due at least in part to the fact that Martin was British. Martin considered himself to know as much about technology as anyone else in the Valley, which was probably true. With advanced degrees from Berkeley and Cambridge and a track record of success as a chief architect at two other technology companies, he was seen as Decision Tech's key competitive advantage, at least when it came to human capital. Unlike Mikey, Martin didn't disrupt staff meetings. In fact, he rarely participated. It wasn't that he refused to attend those meetings. Even Jeff wouldn't allow such a blatant act of revolt. It was just that he always had his laptop open. And he seemed to be constantly checking email or doing something similarly engrossing. Only when someone made a factually incorrect statement could Martin be counted on to offer a comment, and usually a sarcastic one at that. At first, this was tolerable, maybe even amusing, to Martin's peers, who seemed in awe of his intellect, but it began to wear on the staff over time. And with the company's recent struggles, it had become an increasingly grating source of frustration for many of them. JR, sales. In order to avoid confusing him with Jeff Shanley, everyone called the head of sales JR. His real name was Jeff Rollins, but he seemed to enjoy the new moniker. JR was an experienced salesperson and a little older than the others, mid-40s. He was usually tan, never rude, and always agreed to do whatever the staff asked of him. Unfortunately, JR rarely followed through. In those cases when he came clean and acknowledged having made a commitment that went unfulfilled, he apologized profusely to whomever he had let down. In spite of what the staff called JR's flakiness, he was able to maintain a measure of respect from his peers because of his track record. Before coming to Decision Tech, he had never missed a quarterly revenue number in his entire career in sales. Carlos, customer support. Though Decision Tech had relatively few customers, the board felt strongly that the company would need to invest early in customer service in order to prepare for growth. Carlos Amador had worked with Mikey at two previous companies, and she introduced him to the firm, which was ironic because the two of them couldn't have been more different. Carlos spoke very little, but whenever he did, he had something important and constructive to say. He listened intently during meetings, worked long hours with no complaint, and downplayed his prior accomplishments whenever someone asked about them. If there was a low-maintenance member of the staff, and a trustworthy one, it was Carlos. Catherine was thankful not to have to worry about at least one of her new direct reports, although she was somewhat troubled that his specific role had not yet fully developed. The fact that he willingly took on responsibility for product quality and any other unattractive duties that fell through the gaps allowed her to focus on more pressing concerns. Jan, Chief Financial Officer. The role of the Chief Financial Officer had been a critical one at Decision Tech and would continue to be as long as the company intended to go public. Jan Mersino knew what she was getting into when she joined the company, and she played a key role supporting Jeff as he raised impressive amounts of money from venture capitalists and other investors. Jan was a stickler for detail, took pride in her knowledge of the industry, and treated the company's money as though it were her own. While the board had given Jeff and the staff virtual free rein when it came to expenditures, they did so only because they knew that Jan wouldn't let things get out of control. Nick, Chief Operating Officer. The final member of the executive staff was the most impressive on paper. Nick Farrell had been vice president of field operations for a large computer manufacturer in the Midwest and had moved his family to California to take the Decision Tech job. Unfortunately for him, he had the most ill-defined role of anyone on the team. Nick was officially the chief operating officer of the company, but that was only because he had demanded the COO title as a condition of accepting the job. Jeff and the board gave it to him because they believed he would earn it within the year anyway if he performed according to his billing. More importantly, they had become addicted to hiring star executives, and losing Nick would have hurt their winning percentage. Of all the members of the executive staff, Nick had been most directly impacted by the company's sputtering start. Given Jeff's limitations as a manager, Nick had been hired to spearhead Decision Tech's growth, which included building an operational infrastructure, opening new offices around the world, and leading the firm's acquisition and integration efforts. Most of his responsibilities were currently on hold, giving Nick little meaningful day-to-day work. As frustrated as he was, Nick didn't complain openly. To the contrary, he worked hard to build relationships, though sometimes shallow ones, with each of his colleagues, whom he had quietly deemed to be inferior to him. And though he certainly never said so to any of his peers, Nick felt he was the only executive in the company qualified to be CEO. But that would become obvious soon enough. Part 2. Lighting the Fire. First Test. It looked like just another of the many standard email messages that Catherine was receiving on a regular basis now that she had been on the job for a while. The subject header, Customer Opportunity Next Week, seemed innocuous enough, even positive, especially considering that it came from her acerbic chief engineer, Martin. And the note itself was short, the most damaging ones usually are. That it was not addressed to anyone in particular, but was sent to the entire executive staff, only belied its incendiary potential. Just received a call from ASA Manufacturing. They're interested in reviewing our product to consider a purchase next quarter. JR and I will be going down to meet with them next week. Could be a big opportunity. We'll be back early Tuesday. The fact that Martin avoided any mention of the scheduling conflict with the executive retreat only made the situation worse for Catherine. He hadn't asked permission to miss the first day and a half of the off-site retreat, either because he didn't feel the need to do so, or because he wanted to avoid having to deal with the issue altogether. Catherine decided it didn't matter which was true. She resisted the temptation to avoid a confrontation with Martin by firing off an email reply. Catherine decided that this would be her first moment of truth as a CEO, and moments of truth, she knew, are best handled face-to-face. Catherine found Martin sitting in his corner office reading email. His back was turned toward the open door, but she didn't bother knocking. "Excuse me, Martin." Catherine waited for Martin to turn around, which he took his time doing. "I just saw your email about ASA." He nodded, and she went on. "That's great news, but we'll have to push the appointment back a few days because of the off-site." Martin was silent for an awkward moment, then responded without emotion, but with his thickest English accent. "I don't think you understand. This is a potential sales opportunity. You don't just reschedule." Catherine interrupted and responded matter-of-factly. "No, I do understand, but I think they'll still be there next week." Not used to being countered directly, Martin became just slightly agitated. "If your concern is about this Napa off-site thing, then I think we may have our priorities confused. We need to be out there selling." Catherine took a breath and smiled to conceal her frustrations. "First of all, I only have one priority at this point. We need to get our act together as a team, or we're not going to be selling anything." Martin said nothing. After an awkward 5 seconds, Catherine finished the conversation. "So, I'll be seeing you in Napa next week." She turned to leave, then turned back to face Martin again. "Oh, and if you need any help rescheduling the ASA meeting, let me know. I know Bob Tennyson, the CEO down there. He sits on the Trinity board with me, and he owes me a favor." With that, she left the room. Though Martin decided not to push any further for the moment, he was not through fighting. End run. Jeff stopped by Catherine's office the next morning and asked her to lunch. She had planned to run an errand during that time, but happily shifted her schedule to accommodate one of her direct reports. The oldest Mexican restaurant in Half Moon Bay was as good a spot as any for a difficult conversation, he thought, because mostly locals ate there. Before Jeff could broach the topic he wanted to discuss, Catherine took care of some business of her own. "Jeff, I want to thank you for leading the executive staff meetings these past 2 weeks. It's allowed me to sit back and observe." He nodded politely to accept her minor but heartfelt gratitude. She continued, "After next week's offsite, I'll take over, but I want you to know that you shouldn't hold back during the meetings. You should participate as fully as any other staff member." Jeff nodded. "Fine, I don't think that'll be a problem." He paused, then worked up the courage to raise the issue that had provoked the lunch invitation. Straightening his silverware nervously, he began, "Now that you mention the offsite, I'd like to ask you a question." "Go ahead." Catherine was almost amused by Jeff's discomfort. And because she had anticipated a question about her run-in with Martin, she was calm and confident. "Well, yesterday, on the way out of the office, I talked to Martin in the parking lot." He waited, hoping Catherine would jump in and move the conversation forward from there. She didn't. So Jeff continued. "Well, he said something to me about the ASA meeting and the off-site scheduling problem." Again, Jeff paused, hoping for his new boss to mercifully interrupt. This time she did, but only to prompt him to continue. "Yes?" Jeff swallowed. "Well, he believes, and frankly I think I agree with him, that a customer meeting is more important than an internal one. And so, if he and J.R. missed the first day or so of the off-site, I think we would be okay." Catherine chose her words carefully. "Jeff, I understand your opinion, and I'm fine with your disagreeing with me, especially when you tell me face-to-face." Jeff was noticeably relieved for the moment. "However, I was hired to make this organization work, and right now it doesn't." Jeff looked like he was trying to decide whether to be humbled or angry, so Catherine clarified. "I'm not trying to criticize what you've done so far, because it seems to me that no one cares more about the company than you do." His ego now assuaged, Catherine drove the point home. "But from a team standpoint, we are completely broken, and one sales meeting is not going to have a meaningful impact on our future. At least not until we straighten out the leadership problems around here." Not knowing Catherine very well, Jeff decided that any further debate would be fruitless and possibly career-limiting. He nodded as if to say, "Okay, I guess it's your call." The two of them then engaged in small talk and ate one of the fastest lunches in Half Moon Bay history before heading back to the office. Drawing the line. The conversation with Jeff had not fazed Catherine. She had certainly expected some backlash about the Martin incident from her inherited staff, but she didn't expect it to come from the chairman. When he reached her at home that evening, she initially assumed he was calling to give her support. "I just got off the phone with Jeff," he announced in a friendly tone. "So I guess you heard about my headbutt with Martin." Catherine's humorous and confident attitude pushed the chairman into a more serious mood. "Yes, and I'm a little concerned." Catherine was caught off guard. "You are? Look, Catherine, you know I don't want to tell you how to go about doing this, but maybe you should try to build a few bridges over there before you start setting any on fire." Catherine let a few moments pass before replying. As surprised as she was by the chairman's concerns, she was remarkably calm and shifted into CEO mode immediately. "Okay, what I'm about to say is not meant in any way to be defensive or rude." "I know that, Catherine." "Good, because I'm not going to mince my words, not with you. And I appreciate that. You may not, after you hear what I have to say." He forced a laugh. "Okay, I'm sitting down. First, don't think that I'm just randomly setting fires to get my kicks. I've been watching these people carefully for the past 2 weeks, and everything I'm doing and everything I'm about to do is purposeful and intentional. I didn't tweak Martin because I felt like it in the moment. I know, it's just that..." Catherine interrupted politely. "Hear me out. This is important." "Okay, go ahead." "Now, if you knew how to do what I'm trying to do, you wouldn't need me, am I right?" "You're right." "You see, I honestly appreciate your concern for the company and for me, and I know you mean well on both counts. But based on this call, I'd have to say that your good intentions are hurting the company more than helping it." "I'm sorry, but I'm not understanding you," Catherine went on. "Well, over the past 18 months, you've been fairly active with Jeff and the rest of the team, more so than most board chairmen, and you've watched this team spiral further and further into dysfunction and chaos. And now you've asked me to help you pull them out of it. Isn't that what you want?"
"Absolutely. That's exactly what I want."
"Then I have a single question for you. Are you prepared for the consequences of letting me do this right? Now, don't answer right away." She caught him just as the words were coming out of his mouth. "Think about it for a second." She let the question sit there before continuing. "This is not going to be easy or pretty. Not for the company, not for the executives, not for me, and not for you." The chairman remained silent, resisting the temptation to assure her that he was prepared to do whatever she needed. Catherine interpreted his silence as permission to continue her pointed lecture. "You've probably heard my husband say that a fractured team is just like a broken arm or leg. Fixing it is always painful, and sometimes you have to re-break it to make it heal correctly. And the re-break hurts a lot more than the initial break, because you have to do it on purpose." After a long pause, the chairman spoke.
"Okay, Catherine, I hear you. Do whatever you have to do. I won't get in the way."
Catherine could tell that he meant it.
Then he asked, "But I do have one final question. How much of this team are you going to have to re-break?"
"I should know by the end of the month." Napa. Catherine chose the Napa Valley for the off-site because it was close enough to the office to avoid expensive and time-consuming travel, but just far enough to feel out of town. And regardless of how many times people have been there, it always seems to make them slow down a pace or two. The hotel where the meeting would take place was a small inn located in the town of Yountville. Catherine liked it because it was reasonably priced during the off-season and had just one large and comfortable conference room. It was on the second floor, had its own balcony, and overlooked acres of vineyards. The meeting was to start at 9 a.m., which meant that most of the team would have to leave their homes fairly early in the morning to arrive on time. By 8:45, everyone had arrived, checked their luggage at the front desk, and was seated at the conference table. Everyone but Martin, that is. Though no one said anything about him, the way they were checking their watches suggested they were all wondering whether he would be on time. Even Catherine seemed a bit nervous. She didn't want the first activity of the meeting to be a reprimand of someone for being late. Then, for a split second, she felt a flash of panic, wondering what she would do if he just didn't show up at all. She couldn't very well fire him for not coming to a meeting, could she? Did she have that kind of political capital with the board? How valuable is this guy anyway?
When Martin came through the door at 8:59, Catherine breathed an inaudible sigh of relief and chastised herself for worrying so much. She took comfort in knowing that she was finally about to begin what she had been waiting to do for almost a month. And, as concerned as she was about the attitudes of the people sitting around the table, Catherine couldn't deny that moments like this were a big part of why she loved being a leader. The speech. Martin took the only remaining chair at the end of the conference table opposite Catherine. As soon as he sat down, he removed his laptop computer from its case and put it on the table in front of him, leaving it closed for the moment. Determined not to be distracted, Catherine smiled at her staff and addressed them calmly and gracefully. "Good morning, everyone. I'd like to start the day by saying a few words, and this won't be the last time I say them." No one knew just how serious Catherine was about that remark. "We have a more experienced and talented executive team than any of our competitors. We have more cash than they do. Thanks to Martin and his team, we have better core technology. And we have a more powerful board of directors. Yet, in spite of all that, we are behind two of our competitors in terms of both revenue and customer growth. Can anyone here tell me why that is?" Silence. Catherine continued, still as warmly as when she started. "After interviewing with every member of our board and spending time with each of you and then talking to most of our employees, it is very clear to me what our problem is." She paused before completing the thought. "We are not functioning as a team. In fact, we are quite dysfunctional." A few of the staff members shot glances toward Jeff to see how he would react. He seemed fine, but Catherine picked up on the tension. "I'm not saying this to call out Jeff or anyone else in particular. It's just a fact. One that we are going to begin addressing over these next 2 days. And yes, I know how ridiculous and unbelievable it feels for you to be out of the office for so many days this month. But by the end of it all, everyone who is still here will understand why this is so important." That last comment got everyone's attention. "That's right. I want to say right up front that Decision Tech is going to experience some changes during the next few months, and it's very possible that some of us here won't find the new company to be the kind of place where we want to be. That isn't a threat or a dramatic device, and I don't have anyone in particular in mind. It's just a realistic probability, and it's nothing to be in denial about. All of us are eminently employable, and it wouldn't be the end of the world for anyone to leave if that is the right thing for the company and the team." Catherine stood and went to the whiteboard, careful not to come across as arrogant or condescending. "Let me assure those of you who might be wondering about all of this that everything we're going to be doing is about one thing only, making this company succeed. That's all. We're not going to be catching each other falling out of trees." A few of her staff members chuckled. "And we certainly won't be holding hands, singing songs, or getting naked." Even Martin managed to smile while the others laughed out loud. "I want to assure you that there is only one reason that we are here at this offsite and at the company, to achieve results. This, in my opinion, is the only true measure of a team, and it will be the focus of everything we do today and as long as I'm here. It is my expectation that next year and the year after that, we will be able to look back on revenue growth, profitability, customer retention, and satisfaction, and if the market is right for it, maybe even an IPO. But I can promise you that none of that will happen if we do not address the issues that are preventing us from acting like a team." Catherine paused to let everyone digest the simplicity of her message, and then continued. "So, how do we go about this? Over the years, I've come to the conclusion that there are 5 reasons why teams are dysfunctional." She then drew a triangle on the whiteboard and divided it with 4 horizontal lines, creating 5 separate sections. Catherine then turned back to the group. "Over the course of the next 2 days, we are going to be filling in this model and dealing with each issue one at a time. And you'll notice immediately that none of this is rocket science. In fact, it will seem remarkably simple on paper. The trick is putting it into practice. Right now, I'd like to start with the first dysfunction, absence of trust." She turned and wrote the phrase at the bottom of the triangle. The staff members read the words silently, and most of them frowned as if to say, "Is that all you've got?" Catherine was used to this and continued, "Trust is the foundation of real teamwork. And so, the first dysfunction is a failure on the part of team members to understand and open up to one another. And if that sounds touchy-feely, let me explain, because there is nothing soft about it. It is an absolutely critical part of building a team. In fact, It's probably the most critical. Some of the people in the room are clearly in need of an explanation. Great teams do not hold back with one another, she said. They are unafraid to air their dirty laundry. They admit their mistakes, their weaknesses, and their concerns without fear of reprisal. Most of the staff seemed to be accepting the point, but without a lot of enthusiasm. Catherine pushed on. The fact is, if we don't trust one another, and it seems to me that we don't, then we cannot be the kind of team that ultimately achieves results, and so that is where we're going to focus first. Pushing back. The room was silent until Jan raised her hand. Catherine smiled. I may have been a school teacher once, but you don't have to raise your hand to talk. Feel free to jump in any time. Jan nodded and asked her question. I'm not trying to be negative or contradictory here, but I'm just wondering, why don't you think we trust each other? Is it possible that you just don't know us very well yet? Catherine paused to consider the question, wanting to give a thoughtful answer. Well, my assessment is based on quite a bit of data, Jan. Specific comments from the board, employees, even many of you. Jan seemed content with the answer, but Catherine decided to continue. But I'd have to say that more than anything I've been told by others, I see a trust problem here in the lack of debate that exists during staff meetings and other interactions among this team. But I don't want to get ahead of myself because that's a separate part of the model entirely. Nick was not about to let it go. But that doesn't always mean that there's an absence of trust, does it? The question was more of a statement than anything else. Everyone in the room, including Martin and Mikey, seemed eager for Catherine's response. No, not necessarily, I guess. Nick was momentarily pleased that his comment was deemed to be correct, until Catherine clarified. Theoretically, if everyone is completely on the same page and working in lockstep toward the same goals with no sense of confusion, then I suppose a lack of debate might be a good sign. More than one of the staff members began to smile sheepishly at the description that certainly did not apply to them. Nick's satisfaction disappeared. Catherine continued to direct her explanation toward him. But I'd have to say that every effective team I've ever observed had a substantial level of debate. Even the most trusting teams mixed it up a lot. Now she directed a question to the rest of the room. Why do you suppose there's so little passionate discussion or debate among this group? At first, no one answered, and Catherine let them sit in the uncomfortable silence. Then Mikey mumbled something under her breath. I'm sorry, Mikey, I didn't hear you. Catherine did her best to conceal her distaste for sarcastic remarks, which she had developed teaching seventh graders. Mikey clarified, louder now. There isn't enough time. I think we're all too busy having lengthy debates about minor issues. We're drowning in work as it is. Catherine sensed that the others might not agree with Mikey, but she wondered if anyone dared challenge her. She was about to do so herself when Jeff offered tentatively, I'm not sure I'm with you on that one, Mikey. I don't think we lack the time to argue. I think we're just not comfortable challenging each other, and I'm not sure why. Mikey responded quickly, if not sharply, maybe because our meetings are always too structured and boring. The mother and Catherine wanted to step in and protect Jeff, partly to reward him for having stood up to Mikey, but she decided to let things go. After a pause, Carlos chimed in gently but without directing his comments at Mikey, as though the entire group had made the remark. Now wait a minute, everyone. I agree that meetings have been pretty dull and that the agenda is usually a little too full, but I think we all could have challenged each other more. We certainly don't all agree on everything. Nick spoke up. I don't think we agree on anything. They all laughed, except Martin, who had opened his laptop and turned it on. Catherine joined the livening conversation. So, you don't agree on most things, and yet you don't seem willing to admit that you have concerns. Now, I'm no PhD in psychology, but that's a trust issue if I've ever heard one. A few of the heads on the board actually nodded in agreement with Catherine, something she appreciated like a starving person given a few morsels of bread. And then the typing sound began. Martin, now completely checked out of the conversation, was banging away at his keyboard like, well, like a computer programmer. Distracted by the sound, everyone in the room glanced at Martin for a nanosecond. And that was enough to kill whatever momentum the conversation had generated. Catherine had both relished this moment and dreaded it from the first staff meeting she had observed. And as much as she wanted to avoid another run-in with Martin, especially so early in the day, she wouldn't let the opportunity pass her by. Entering the danger. The tension in the room had begun to mount as Catherine watched Martin type away at the other end of the table. No one really thought she would say anything, but they didn't know Catherine very well. "Excuse me, Martin." Martin finished typing and then looked up to acknowledge his boss. "Are you working on something?" Catherine's question was sincere, without even a hint of sarcasm. The room froze, waiting anxiously for the answer to the question they'd been wanting to ask for the past 2 years. Martin seemed as though he wasn't going to respond at all, then said, "I'm taking notes, actually," and continued typing. Catherine remained calm and continued to speak in a measured tone. "I think this is a good time to talk about ground rules for the offsite and for our meetings going forward." Martin looked up from his computer, and Catherine continued, directing her comments to the entire group. "I don't have a lot of rules when it comes to meetings, but there are a few that I'm a stickler about." Everyone waited for her to begin. "Basically, I want you all to do two things: be present and participate. That means everyone needs to be fully engaged in whatever we're talking about." Even Martin knew when to pull back a little. He asked a question, but in a slightly conciliatory tone that the group was not accustomed to hearing from their chief scientist.
"What about when the conversation is not relevant to everyone? Sometimes it seems that we talk about issues that would best be handled offline, one-on-one."
"That's a good point." Catherine was reeling Martin in now. "If there is ever a time when that happens, when we think that we're wasting the group's time by dealing with issues that should be dealt with outside the meeting, then everyone here should feel free to speak up." Martin seemed pleased that she had agreed with him. Catherine went on, "But for everything else, I want everyone fully engaged, and while I understand that some people prefer to use a computer rather than a notebook, like you, Martin, I found that it's just too distracting. It's easy to imagine the person sitting there checking email or working on something else." Mikey decided to come to Martin's aid, something he didn't want or need. "Catherine, with all due respect, you haven't worked within the high-tech culture, and this is pretty common in software companies. I mean, maybe not in the automotive world, but..." Catherine interrupted politely. "Actually, this is very common in the automotive world. I had the same issue there. It's more of a behavioral issue than a technological one." Jeff nodded and smiled as if to say, "Good answer." And with that, Martin closed his laptop and put it in his computer case. More than one of the staff members looked at Catherine as if she had just talked a bank robber into handing over his gun. If only the rest of the day would be so easy. Getting naked. Catherine knew that she was about to begin a deceptively critical part of the session, one that would give her clues as to how things might unfold during the months ahead. It was no accident that it was the first real exercise on the agenda. Before we get into any heavy lifting, let's start with something that I call personal histories. Catherine explained that everyone would answer 5 non-intrusive personal questions having to do with their backgrounds, and she ended her instructions with a humorous caveat that even Martin seemed to appreciate. "Remember, I want to hear about your life as a child, but I'm not interested in your inner child." One by one, the decision tech executives answered the questions: hometown, number of kids in the family, interesting childhood hobbies, biggest challenge growing up, first job. Almost to a person, every set of answers contained a gem or two that few, if any, of the other executives knew. Carlos was the oldest of 9 kids. Mikey studied ballet at the Juilliard School in New York. Jeff had been a bat boy for the Boston Red Sox. Martin spent much of his childhood in India. JR has an identical twin brother. Jan was a military brat. During the discussion, Nick even discovered that he had played basketball in high school against the team coached by Catherine's husband. As for Catherine, her staff seemed most surprised and impressed not by her military training or automotive experience, but by the fact that she had been an All-American volleyball player in college. It was really quite amazing. After just 45 minutes of extremely mild personal disclosure, the team seemed tighter and more at ease with each other than at any time during the past year. But Catherine had been through this enough to know that the euphoria would diminish as soon as the conversation shifted to work. Going deeper. When the team returned from a short break, it was clear that they had already lost some of the glow from the morning session. They spent the next several hours working through lunch, reviewing their individual behavioral tendencies according to a variety of diagnostic tools that they had completed before coming to Napa. One of these was the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator. Catherine was pleasantly surprised that even Martin seemed to be engaged in the discussion. But then again, she reasoned, everyone likes to learn about and talk about themselves. Until the criticism comes, that is. And it was about to come. But Catherine decided that late afternoon was a bad time to dive into the next phase, given everyone's energy level. So she gave them a break for a few hours in the afternoon, to check email, exercise, or do whatever else they wanted. Catherine knew they would be working late that night, and she didn't want them to get burned out too early. Martin spent most of the afternoon break reading email in his room. Nick, Jeff, Carlos, and JR played bocce ball on the court next to the hotel, and Catherine and Jan met in the lobby to talk about budgets. Mikey sat by the pool and read a novel. When they returned around dinner time, Catherine was pleased to see them pick up the conversation where it had ended earlier. By now, everyone had acknowledged their different interpersonal styles at work and discussed the implications of being an introvert versus an extrovert and other similar qualities. They all were definitely loosening up. People were eating pizza and beer, which made everything seem less threatening. Suddenly, Carlos was teasing Jan for being too anal, while Jeff razzed JR for being unfocused. Even Martin responded well when Nick called him a raging introvert. No one at the table was fazed by the good-natured but substantive ribbing, with the exception of Mikey. It wasn't that she took their teasing badly. Worse yet, no one teased her at all. In fact, they made no comments about her, and, unsurprisingly, she made almost none about them. Catherine wanted to bring her into the process, but decided not to be too aggressive so soon. Things were going well, better than she had expected, and the team seemed willing to talk about some of the dysfunctional behaviors that Catherine had observed during staff meetings. There was no need to create a controversy on the first night, especially after already having dodged a few bullets with Martin. But sometimes things can't be controlled, and Mikey herself opened up the door to her own issues. When Nick remarked to the group that he found the personality descriptions to be amazingly accurate and helpful, Mikey did what she so often did during staff meetings. She rolled her eyes. Catherine was about to call her on her behavior when Nick beat her to it. What was that all about? Mikey reacted as though she had no idea what he was referring to. What? Nick was mostly teasing her, but he was clearly a little annoyed. Come on, you rolled your eyes. Did I say something stupid? She persisted in feigning ignorance. No, I didn't say anything. Now Jan jumped in, but gently. You didn't have to say anything, Mikey. It was the look on your face. Jan wanted to defuse the situation by helping Mikey fess up without losing face. Sometimes I think that you don't even know you're doing it. But Mikey wouldn't bite, and she was beginning to get ever so slightly defensive. I really don't know what you're talking about. Nick couldn't hold back. Come on, you do it all the time. It's like you think we're all idiots. Catherine made a mental note not to have beer brought with dinner next time, but she couldn't deny being glad that things were coming to the surface. She took a bite of pizza and watched with everyone else, resisting the temptation to make artificial peace. Out of nowhere, Mikey responded, Listen, you guys, I'm not into all this psychobabble. I don't think any of our competitors who happen to be kicking our asses right now or sitting around a hotel in Napa talking about where they get their energy or how they see the world. The room was caught off guard by the indictment of the entire process, which they seemed to be enjoying, and looked to Catherine to see how she would respond. But Martin beat her to it. Yeah, you're right. People were shocked that Martin, who seemed engaged in the process, was defending Mikey, until he completed the punchline of his remark. They're probably in Carmel. Had anyone else said it, the room would have chuckled. But coming from Martin and directed at Mikey in his dry, sarcastic accent, it made everyone howl, except, of course, Mikey, who just sat there smiling painfully. For a moment, Catherine thought her marketing VP would walk out. That might have been better than what she did. For the next 90 minutes, Mikey didn't say a word, but sat silently as the group continued their discussion. Eventually, the topic naturally drifted toward more tactical topics related to the business. Jan interrupted the conversation and asked Catherine, Are we getting off track here? Catherine shook her head. No, I think it's good that we dive into operational issues while we're talking about behavioral stuff. It gives us a chance to see how we put this into action. As happy as Catherine was by the interaction that was taking place among the rest of the team, she couldn't overlook the fact that Mikey's behavior was speaking volumes about her inability to trust her teammates. Poolside. Catherine called the session to an end a little after 10 p.m., and, with the exception of Jan and Nick, who had just begun an impromptu budget discussion, the team headed to bed. Mikey and Catherine's rooms were near the pool at the small hotel complex, and as they walked to their rooms, Catherine decided to see if she could make some progress one-on-one. "You okay?" Catherine was careful not to be too dramatic or maternal. "I'm fine." Mikey wasn't faking very well. "I know this is a difficult process and that you might feel like they're a little tough on you." "A little? Listen, I don't let people make fun of me at home, and I sure as hell don't want people to do it at work. Those guys have no idea about how to make a company successful." Catherine was almost too confused by the scattershot reply to respond. After a few moments, she said, "Well, we can talk about that tomorrow. I think they need to hear what you think." "Oh, I'm not going to say anything tomorrow." Catherine tried not to overreact to Mikey's comment, which she attributed more to her momentary emotions than anything else. "I think you'll feel better in the morning." "No, I'm serious. They aren't going to hear from me." Catherine decided to let it go for the moment. "Well, get a good night's sleep." They're at their rooms now. Mikey ended the conversation with a sarcastic laugh. "I will." Rebound. Only Catherine and Jan were in the conference room when Mikey arrived the next morning. She seemed enthusiastic and unbowed by the previous day's events, which was a pleasant surprise for Catherine. Once the others had arrived, Catherine kicked off the session with an abbreviated version of the prior day's speech. "Okay, before we get started, I think it's good to remember why we are here. We have more cash, more experienced executives, better technology, and more connections than any of our competitors, and yet at least two of them are ahead of us in the market. Our job is to increase revenue, profitability, and customer acquisition and retention, and maybe even put ourselves in a position for an IPO. But none of this will happen if we don't function as a team." She paused, surprised at how closely her report seemed to be listening. It was as if they were hearing it for the first time. "Any questions?" Instead of just sitting there silently, a number of the staff members shook their heads as if to say, "No questions, let's get started." At least, that's how Catherine interpreted it. For the next few hours, the group reviewed the material they had covered the previous day. After an hour or so, Martin and Nick seemed to be losing a little interest, and JR became more distracted each time his cell phone vibrated and went unanswered. Catherine decided to address their concerns before they started talking among themselves. "I know that you're all probably starting to wonder, didn't we do this yesterday? And I realize it's repetitive. But this stuff won't stick unless we understand how to apply it completely." For another hour, the group discussed the implications of their various style preferences and the collective opportunities and challenges that those styles created. Mikey made few comments, and whenever she did speak, the flow of conversation seemed to slow dramatically. Martin, too, said little, but seemed to be paying attention and following the conversation nonetheless. By mid-morning, they had completed their review of interpersonal styles and team behaviors. And then, with less than an hour until lunch, Catherine decided to introduce the most important exercise of the day, one that she would look back on later as a moment of truth for Mikey and the rest of the team. Awareness. Walking back to the whiteboard, Catherine explained, "Remember, teamwork begins by building trust, and the only way to do that is to overcome our need for invulnerability." She wrote the word invulnerability next to trust on the whiteboard. Then she continued, "And so, we're all going to demonstrate vulnerability this morning in a low-risk but relevant way." She then asked everyone to spend 5 minutes deciding what they believed were their single biggest strength and weakness in terms of their contribution to Decision Tech's success or failure. "I don't want you to give me some generic weakness, and I don't want you glossing over your strengths because you're too modest or embarrassed to tell us what you think you're really good at. Take this simple exercise seriously and be willing to put yourself out there." When it was clear that everyone had finished jotting down their notes, Catherine began the discussion. "Okay, I'll go first." She looked at her notes briefly. "I think my biggest strength, at least the strength that will have the biggest impact on our success, is my ability to see through fluffy, superfluous information and cut to the point that matters. I have a way of eliminating unnecessary details and getting to the heart of an issue, and that should save us a lot of time." She paused before continuing. "My weakness is that I am not the world's best external spokesperson. In fact, I'm bad at it. I tend to downplay the importance of public relations, and I'm not a talented or tactful speaker when it comes to being in front of a large group, or, even worse, a television camera. I'm going to need help with that if we're going to accomplish everything that we hope to. With the exception of JR and Mikey, everyone was taking notes as Catherine spoke. She liked that. Okay, who wants to go next? No one volunteered immediately. Everyone was looking around, some hoping that one of their peers would volunteer. Others seemed to be asking permission to step forward. Finally, Nick broke the ice. I'll go. Okay, let's see. He reviewed his notes. My biggest strength is my lack of fear when it comes to negotiation and management of outside companies, whether they're partners, vendors, or competitors. I don't have any problem pushing them to do more than they want to do. My biggest weakness, however, is that I sometimes come across as arrogant. A few of Nick's peers laughed a little nervously. He smiled and continued, "Yes, I've had that problem since I was in college, and probably before. I can be sarcastic and even rude at times, and sometimes I come across sounding like I think I'm smarter than everyone else. And that might be okay, I suppose, if I'm dealing with a vendor, but with you guys, it could probably piss you off a little, which I don't think is going to help us get where we want to go." Jeff commented, "It sounds like your strength and weakness are rooted in the same things." Martin, to everyone's surprise, voiced his agreement. "Isn't that usually the case?" Heads around the table nodded. Catherine was impressed by the apparent honesty of Nick's remarks and the willingness of the other staff members to make comments. She was glad he went first. "Good. That was exactly the kind of thing I'm looking for. Who's next?" Jan volunteered and talked about her management skills and attention to detail as strengths, something everyone agreed with immediately. Then she admitted being more conservative about finances than the CFO of a startup should be. She explained that this was a result of her training at larger companies and her concern that her peers were not concerned enough about managing expenses. "Still, I am probably making it harder for you all to meet me halfway by being so controlling." Carlos assured her that the rest of the group could probably take a step or two in her direction. Jeff went next. He struggled in his attempt to call out his amazing networking skills and ability to build partnerships with investors and partners, but Jan wouldn't let him off the hook. "Come on now, Jeff. If we've done one thing well, it's been raising boatloads of money and getting investors excited about the company. Don't downplay your role in that." Jeff reluctantly accepted her kind-hearted rebuke and then blew everyone away with his admission of weakness. "I am pretty afraid to fail, and so I tend to over-engineer things and do them myself. I don't like to tell other people what to do, which, ironically, only makes it more likely that I'm going to fail." For the slightest moment, Jeff seemed to fight back emotions and then recovered instantly. He was sure no one noticed, and I think that's probably the biggest reason that we haven't succeeded and that I'm not the CEO anymore. He paused and then added quickly, "Which I'm okay with, really. In fact, I'm pretty happy to be out of that job." The group laughed in a supportive way. Catherine couldn't believe that the first three people that stepped forward had done so well. For a moment, she began to entertain hopes that the momentum would continue and the day would be a runaway hit. And then Mikey spoke. "Okay, I'll go next." Unlike her peers who had gone before her, Mikey looked at her notes almost the entire time that she talked. "My biggest strength is my understanding of the technology market and how to communicate with analysts and the media. My biggest weakness is my poor financial skills." Silence. No comments, no questions, nothing. Like Catherine, most everyone in the room was torn between two emotions. Relief that Mikey was finished, and disappointment at the shallow nature of her response. At that moment, Catherine didn't feel that it would be right to force her vice president of marketing to be more vulnerable. Mikey had to do it herself. With every second that went by, the group quietly begged for someone to break the silence. Carlos put them out of their misery. "Okay, I'll go next." Doing his best to bring the quality of the conversation back to a higher level, he talked about his follow-through as a strength and his failure to update people on his progress as a weakness. After he finished, Jan jumped in. "Carlos, I think you missed on both of your answers." Catherine, not knowing that Carlos and Jan had become fairly close, was surprised by the directness of her remark. Jan continued, "First, as thorough as you are, your willingness to do the shit work and not complain is your strength. I know that sounds terrible, but I don't know what would happen around here if you weren't bailing us out all the time. A number of the others voiced their agreement. And, on the negative side, I think you could tell us what you're thinking more during meetings. You hold back too much. Everyone seemed to wait to see how Carlos would respond, but he just nodded his head and took a note. Okay. J.R. volunteered to go next and brought the room to a roar when he explained, "Clearly, my biggest strength is my follow-through and attention to detail." The group enjoyed the laughter for a few minutes until J.R. continued, "Seriously, I'm pretty good at building strong personal relationships with customers. In fact, I'm really good at that." He said it modestly enough for everyone to appreciate. "On the downside, if I don't think something is terribly important, which usually means it isn't going to get me closer to closing a deal, I can sometimes blow it off." "Sometimes?" asked Nick. The room howled again. J.R. blushed. I know. I just can't seem to get around to my to-do list. I don't know why, but I think that hurts the team." Martin was the only remaining executive. "Okay, I think I'm next." He took a deep breath. "I hate talking about myself this way, but if I have to, I'd say that I'm good at solving problems, doing analysis, stuff like that. What I'm not so good at is communicating with human beings." He stopped. "I mean, it's not that I can't do it, but I really prefer people who aren't sensitive. I like to have conversations with people on a purely intellectual level and not to have to worry about what they're feeling or anything like that. Does that make sense?" "Sure," said Jeff, who decided to take a risk. "The problem is that it can sometimes make people think you don't like them, that they're a waste of your time." Martin seemed visibly disappointed by Jeff's remark. "No, that's not it at all. I mean, that's not what I intend. Crap. That's bad. I don't mean that at all, but I suppose I can see how it comes across that way. I don't know how to change that." For the first time all morning, Mikey chimed in, smiling. "Years of psychotherapy, my friend, and even then you probably won't be able to change it. You're just an arrogant SOB. But then again, isn't every CTO in the Valley?" Mikey laughed. No one else did, with the exception of Martin, who seemed embarrassed by her remark and wanted to add to its sense of being humorous. Inside, he was melting. Catherine would later kick herself for not calling Mikey on a remark, which at the time Catherine attributed to her astonishingly low emotional intelligence. Whatever the case, it was clear to her now that Mikey's behavior was having a very real impact on the rest of the group. Ego. When everyone had found their seats around the table, Catherine announced the change in direction. "Okay, we're going to move all the way to the final dysfunction, but we'll be revisiting the fear of vulnerability topic and the need for trust many, many times again over the course of the next month. If anyone isn't looking forward to that, you'd better brace yourself." Everyone assumed she was talking to Mikey. None of them could have guessed that another member of the team was struggling as much as she was. Catherine described the next dysfunction by going to the whiteboard and writing the phrase, "inattention to results," at the top of the triangle. "We're going to the top of the chart now to talk about the ultimate dysfunction, the tendency of team members to seek out individual recognition and attention at the expense of results. And I'm referring to collective results, the goals of the entire team." Nick asked, "Is this about ego?" "Well, I suppose that's part of it," agreed Catherine. "But I'm not saying that there's no place for ego on a team. The key is to make the collective ego greater than the individual ones." "I'm not sure I understand what this has to do with results," Jeff remarked. "Well, when everyone is focused on results and using those to define success, it is difficult for ego to get out of hand. No matter how good an individual on the team might be feeling about his or her situation, if the team loses, everyone loses." Catherine could see that a few of her reports were not quite with her yet, so she took another approach. "I told you yesterday that my husband is a basketball coach at St. Jude's High School in San Mateo." "He's a damn good basketball coach," explained Nick. "He's been getting job offers from colleges since I was in high school, and every year he turns them down. He's a legend." Catherine was proud of her husband and enjoyed Nick's commentary. "Yeah, I suppose he is something of an anomaly, and he's certainly good at what he does. Anyway, he is all about the team. And as good as his teams are, few of his kids play ball at big colleges because, frankly, they're not all that talented. They win because they play team basketball, and that usually allows them to beat bigger, faster, and more talented groups of players." Nick was nodding his head with the certainty of someone who had lost to St. Jude's many times. "Well, Every once in a while, Ken, that's my husband, gets a player on his team who doesn't really care about results, or at least not the results of the team. I remember a kid a few years ago who was interested only in his own statistics and whether he received individual recognition, all-league, picture in the paper, that sort of stuff. If the team lost, he'd be in a good mood as long as he was getting his points. And even when the team won, he would be unhappy if he didn't score enough. Jan was curious. What did your husband do about him? Catherine smiled, eager to tell them more about Ken. That's the interesting thing. This kid was without a doubt one of the most talented players on the team. But Ken benched him. The team played better without him, and he eventually quit.
Harsh, remarked J.R.
Yeah, but he came out the next year with a very different attitude, and went on to play for St. Mary's College after he graduated. He'll tell you now that it was the most important year of his life. Jan was still curious. Do you think most people like that can change? Catherine didn't hesitate. No. For every kid like that one, there are 10 who never made it. The group seemed sobered by the definitive response, and more than one of them were thinking about Mikey at that moment. And as harsh as that may sound, Ken always says that his job is to create the best team possible, not to shepherd the careers of individual athletes, and that's how I look at my job. Jeff decided to ask the group a question. Anyone here play team sports in high school or college? Catherine wanted to stop Jeff's poll and keep the discussion moving in the direction she had planned, but she decided that a little impromptu discussion was probably as valuable for the team as anything else, as long as it had something to do with teamwork. Jeff went around the room, giving every person a chance to respond to his question. Nick reported that he'd played baseball in college. Carlos was a linebacker in high school. Martin probably announced, "I played football, the original kind." Everyone chuckled at their European colleague. Mikey said she ran track in high school. When Nick questioned her, "But that's an individual," she interrupted him cleverly, "I ran on the relay team." Catherine reminded everyone that she was a volleyball player. Jan reported that she was a cheerleader and a member of the dance team. "And if anyone here says those aren't teams, I'm going to cut your budget in half," they laughed. Jeff confessed his lack of athletic aptitude. "You see, I don't understand why everyone thinks sports is the only way to learn about teamwork. I never played sports much, even as a kid, but I was in a band in high school and college, and I think I figured out the team thing from that." Catherine saw an opportunity to regain control of the discussion. "Aha, that's a good point. First of all, you can definitely learn teamwork from lots of different activities, pretty much anything that involves a group of people working together. But there's a reason that sports are so prevalent when it comes to teams." The seventh grade teacher and Catherine suddenly emerged, wanting to give her pupils a chance to answer her next question themselves. "Does anyone know what that is?" Like so many times in her classroom, the group seemed to have no clue. But Catherine knew that if she could tolerate the silence for a moment, soon enough someone would come up with the answer. This time it was Martin. "The score." As usual, Martin provided little context for his answer. "Explain," commended Catherine, just as she would have done with one of her students. "Well, in most sports, there is a clear score at the end of the game that determines whether you succeeded or failed. There is little room for ambiguity, which means there is little room for..." He paused to find the right words. "For subjective, interpretive, ego-driven success, if you know what I mean." Heads around the room nodded to say that everyone did. "Wait a second," demanded J.R. "Are you telling me that athletes don't have egos?" Martin seemed at a loss, so Catherine jumped in. "Well, they have huge egos, but great athletes' egos are usually tied to a clear result, winning. They just want to win. More than making the all-star team, more than getting their picture on a box of Wheaties, and yes, more than making money. I'm not sure there are many of those kinds of teams around anymore, at least not in professional sports," declared Nick. Catherine smiled, "and that's the beauty. The teams that figure it out have a bigger advantage than ever before because most of their competitors are just a bunch of individuals looking out for themselves." Mikey was looking a little bored. "What does this have to do with the software company?" Again, Mikey brought the conversation to a halt. But Catherine wanted to encourage her in any way she could, though she was already starting to doubt the likelihood of turning her around. "Another good question. This has everything to do with us. You see, we're going to make our collective results as important as the score at a football game. We aren't going to leave any room for interpretation when it comes to our success, because that only creates the opportunity for individual ego to sneak in." Don't we already have a scoreboard? Mikey persisted. You're talking about profit? Asked Catherine. Mikey nodded and made a face, as if to say, what else? Catherine continued patiently. Certainly, profit is a big part of it, but I'm talking more about near-term results. If you let profit be your only guide to results, you won't be able to know how the team is doing until the season is almost over. Now I'm confused, admitted Carlos. Isn't profit the only score that matters? Catherine smiled. Yeah, I'm starting to get a little too academic here, so let me make this simple. Our job is to make the results that we need to achieve so clear to everyone in this room that no one would even consider doing something purely to enhance his or her individual status or ego, because that would diminish our ability to achieve our collective goals. We would all lose. Something seemed to be catching on just slightly, so Catherine pushed forward. The key, of course, is to define our goals, our results, in a way that is simple enough to grasp easily and specific enough to be actionable. Profit is not actionable enough. It needs to be more closely related to what we do on a daily basis. And to that end, let's see if we can come up with something right now.